Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Ambulances rushed to the scene in Istanbul, where an explosion rocked a busy pedestrian street, killing six people and wounding more than 80 others Sunday. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan stopped shy of calling it a terrorist attack. The area of Turkey's largest city had been crowded with shoppers, tourists, and families. Authorities say someone has been arrested for the explosion. U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are due to meet at the G20 summit in Bali, their first in-person conversation since Mr. Biden became president. AP correspondent Karen Chamas.
The highly anticipated meeting will enable both leaders to figure out how to manage a relationship that the U.S. has determined poses the biggest economic and military threat. Biden said he wanted to know where Xi stands.
I know Xi Jinping. I spend more time than any other world leader. I know him well. He knows me. There's no, we have very little misunderstanding. We just got to figure out where the red lines are and what are the most important things to each of us.
Xi has yet to give a wish list for talks with Biden, but Beijing wants U.S. action on trade and Taiwan. I'm Karen Chamas.
British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak headed to his debut G20 summit Sunday, urging world powers to unite against exploitation of the global economy by malign actors. After becoming the UK's third premier this year, Sunak is set to have his first bilateral meetings with U.S. President Joe Biden and other world leaders at the summit in Bali, Indonesia. Beyond supporting Western unity against Russia over Ukraine, Sunak wants allies to shore up the international financial system, including the World Trade Organization. This according to Downing Street. This is VOA News. 1 week into this year's UN climate summit in Egypt, frustrations are starting to flare, with negotiators worried about resolving the many details in time for a deal by the summit's scheduled close Friday. With a long list of demands for COP27, country delegates said on Sunday there had been little progress so far on the technical details of how to deliver on deals and pledges made in previous years. COP27 featured no public event Sunday, dubbed by organizers as a day of rest. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said on Sunday he would have to deal with Benjamin Netanyahu, the former Israeli prime minister who won re-election this month. Abbas told Palestine television he has no other choice but to deal with Netanyahu, a man Abbas says is not interested in making peace. The Palestinian leader, whose authority has limited control in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, said there must be a peaceful resolution to the decades-long conflict. Lines have formed at one of Italy's northern border crossings, with France following Paris's decision to reinforce border controls over a diplomatic standoff with Italy about migration policy and humanitarian rescue ships. The crossing along the otherwise picturesque Mediterranean coast has often been a flashpoint of the migrant debate, with makeshift camps giving shelter to migrants who try to cross into France after arriving in Italy. Tens of thousands took to the streets in Mexico on Sunday to protest President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's plan to overhaul the country's electoral commission in what they fear would concentrate power in the hands of the government. López Obrador put the plan forward in April and has long criticized the country's electoral authorities, including accusing them of helping to engineer his defeats when he ran for the presidency in 2006 and 2012. Police in the Bahamas said Sunday they are investigating a cryptocurrency company. The country is a tax haven where the troubled cryptocurrency platform FTX has its headquarters. FTX announced Friday it has filed for protection from creditors under U.S. bankruptcy law, the latest twist in a saga that reverberated across the digital currency landscape. The Bahamas police said in a statement published on Facebook that a team of financial investigators from the Financial Crimes Investigation Branch are working closely with the Bahamas Security Commission to investigate if any criminal misconduct occurred. From Washington, via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Monday, November 19th and 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, British Defense Chief wants Russia still a threat to Ukraine despite its shock retreat from Kherson.
They've effectively degraded massively the Russian armed forces and have taken back the only objective left. So psychologically, Russia will be worried and disappointed by this, but you never underestimate Russia.
The Venezuelan government closes 94 independent radio stations, drawing protests from journalists and opposition leaders.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's pressure on the country's media has contributed to Venezuela's ranking as one of the 30 lowest-rated countries in the 2022 World Press Freedom Index.
And Slovenia elects first woman president in a runoff vote. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. British Defense Minister Ben Wallace said on Sunday Ukraine has the momentum in its war with Russia, but Moscow is a long way from giving up. This as President Vladimir Zelensky said investigators had uncovered more than 400 Russian war crimes and found bodies of both servicemen and civilians in areas of Kherson region freed from Russian occupation. British Defense Minister Ben Wallace.
Quite right, Ukraine has taken back the only objective of the many that Russia managed to capture back in sort of March. Kherson was one of the many objectives. Russia failed. Now Ukraine has got that back, and it basically begs the question to the Russian population, effectively, what was it all for? But also it shows a remarkable capability by Ukraine, who many people across the world didn't think would last more than a few weeks. They've not only lasted a few weeks, they've lasted many months. They've effectively degraded massively the Russian armed forces and have taken back the only objective left. So psychologically, Russia will be worried and disappointed by this. But you never underestimate Russia. History will remind you that Russia can be brutal to their own. And if they need more cannon fodder, that is what they'll be doing. And we see today that they announced, children in schools are going to be trained. And that's the type of regime we're up against.
That's British Defense Minister Ben Wallace. Turkey has launched a probe into a bomb explosion at a popular Istanbul shopping center Sunday that killed at least 6 people dead and more than 800 others injured. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the attack had what he called, quote, the smell of terror, unquote. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul.
Ambulances rushed the injured to nearby hospitals while police secured the blast scene. İstiklal Avenue, in the heart of Istanbul, was packed with locals and tourists when the powerful blast ripped through the area at around 4:20 local time. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke to reporters after the blast.
Öncelikle bugün saat 16:20 sularında.
He said, first of all, I would like to express my condolences to those who were killed in the bomb attack and wish a speedy recovery to those who were wounded in İstiklal Avenue today. Kurdish separatists and Islamic militants have bombed Turkish cities in the past. Erdogan said Sunday's blast was likely due to terrorism.
Kesin olarak bu terördür.
He said it would be wrong to say this is undoubtedly a terrorist attack. But the initial developments and initial intelligence from my governor is that it smells like terrorism. Erdogan also said that those who were engaged in terrorism against Turkey were defeated in the past and would be in the future. The Turkish leader pledged that those responsible for Sunday's blast would be found and punished. So far, no one has claimed responsibility. In 2015 and 2016, the Islamic State militant group carried out a wave of fatal bombings in Istanbul, targeting tourists, including İstiklal Avenue, the scene of Sunday's explosion. The 2016 attack killed at least 5 people, including 2 Israelis and 2 Americans. Turkish authorities have imposed strict controls on local media reporting on Sunday's explosion. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. President Joe Biden is in Bali, Indonesia for the summit of the G20 group of major economies. Biden, who arrives off the back of his attendance at the COP27 climate summit in Egypt and the ASEAN summit in Cambodia, is set to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping and other leaders to address a range of geopolitical issues this week. White House Bureau Chief Pasi Weda-Skuwara has this report from Phnom Penh.
At the U.S.-ASEAN summit in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, President Joe Biden reaffirmed to Southeast Asian nations that the U.S. is committed to ASEAN centrality, the principle that regional engagements are driven by the 10-country bloc, not great power rivalry.
ASEAN is the heart of my administration's Indo-Pacific strategy, and we continue to strengthen our commitment to work in lockstep with an empowered, unified ASEAN.
Political violence in Myanmar since last year's military coup against the government led by Aung San Suu Kyi is high on the agenda. Leaders have warned Myanmar's junta to implement ASEAN's peace plan or continue being barred from the bloc's meetings. Indonesian President Joko Widodo will assume ASEAN's chair next year. He is expected to take a tougher approach than the current chair, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen. Biden met with Hun Sen, the region's authoritarian longest-ruling leader in office since 1985. Activists have urged Biden to hold Hun Sen accountable for the country's democratic decline. But with Phnom Penh firmly in Beijing's embrace, there may not be much that Biden can do. During his meeting with Hun Sen earlier this week, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang pledged $27 million in development aid for Cambodia. There's concern that Cambodia is secretly allowing Chinese warships to dock in its Ream naval base in the Gulf of Thailand. Earlier this year, Beijing provided funds to revamp the base, heightening fears among some ASEAN members concerned about Chinese expansionist ambition in the South China Sea. Biden ended his first day in Cambodia at a gala dinner with ASEAN leaders and the bloc's partners. He'll continue meeting Sunday before heading to Bali, Indonesia for the G20 summit. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Thank you, Patsy. So far this year, at least 94 Venezuelan radio stations have been closed due to lack of licensing, according to the state communications regulator. Journalists and opposition leaders see this as a way of silencing independent information in the run-up to the 2024 presidential elections. For VOA News, Alvaro Algarra has a report from Caracas, narrated by Christine Caicedo-Smith.
Last month, the Venezuelan National Union of Press Workers denounced the decision to close 15 independent radio stations in October. These closures are in addition to 79 others this year by the Venezuelan National Telecommunications Commission, known as CONATEL, the Venezuelan Press Freedom Organization, Espacio Público, or Public Space, says this latest government action is a way to ensure it owns the airwaves. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's pressure on the country's media has contributed to Venezuela's ranking as one of the 30 lowest-rated countries in the 2022 World Press Freedom Index, published by Reporters Without Borders. Opposition leader Elias Ayeg says the situation has left thousands of journalists unemployed and thousands of citizens without a reliable source of unbiased news.
These are families that have lost their livelihood simply because CONATEL, the National Telecommunications Commission, decided through an administrative decision that these people had to lose their jobs.
Diosdado Cabello, a Venezuelan politician, says the wave of closures isn't about what the radio stations are broadcasting. Rather, it's because they don't have up-to-date licenses to operate. A law passed in 2001 required all radio and TV stations to apply for new broadcast licenses with CONATEL. The government says the stations that were shut down failed to obtain those new licenses. But critics say the government isn't granting new licenses and is using the law as a tool to close stations critical of the Maduro government. The closure have forced many journalists to leave, though some continue to report on the situation in Venezuela from outside the country. For Alvaro Algarra in Caracas, Venezuela, Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
Malaysians go to the polls to vote in the nation's general elections on November 19th. Young people are expected to have the biggest impact on the election's outcome, and candidates are busy trying to win their support. Dave Gronenbaum has more.
Ibrahim Soufian, programs director for the Merdeka Center for Opinion Research, says about 60% of Malaysia's eligible voters are younger than 40. Political parties are trying to appeal to them with young candidates, while candidates of all ages are prioritizing outreach to young voters.
We have done our surveys and we found that 70% of young people do not trust politicians or political parties. They trust personalities more. And so I think a lot of these political parties are reorienting the image of their leaders to show them more as caring and forceful personalities that have real causes that they are fighting for, as opposed to politicians that are just pitching for support.
Nasri Hashim is 29, married with a 2-year-old son. He says together with his wife, they earn about $750 a month, making it tough to handle day-to-day expenses and buy a home.
We living in KL, cannot afford to buy a new house, you know, because of the pricing is unaffordable.
Stacy Wong is 20 and voting for the first time. She's researching which candidates are committed to her top priorities.
Education, infrastructure, clean government.
Chin Zin is graduating from university next year. He says his classmates are worried about their job prospects.
I would say there are a lot. There will be a lot more graduates graduating than jobs opening. There will be a oversupply of candidates and undersupply of open careers.
With Election Day approaching, young voters say they want a government that focuses on their future. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
A senior Ethiopian government official says federal government forces now control the majority of the country's northern Tigray region following the signing of a peace deal last month that provides for the disarming of rebel fighters. Fred Hartog reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Redwan Hussein, the National Security Advisor to Ethiopia's Prime Minister, said that 70% of Tigray is under the control of the federal military. He also said that 35 trucks of food and 3 of medicine have reached the city of Shire in northwestern Tigray, which hosts large numbers of people displaced by the war in Tigray, adding that services are being reconnected. Aid is flowing like no other times, said Redwan. Spokespersons for the International Committee for the Red Cross and the World Food Programme were not able to immediately confirm Redwan's comments, which came as representatives from the federal government and Tigray met in Nairobi to discuss the implementation of a ceasefire deal struck in South Africa last week. Under the deal, federal forces will take control of Tigray's capital, airports and borders. The agreement also states that the Tigray rebel forces, estimated to number around 200,000, will disarm. In a statement to the AFP news agency, the Tigray rebels have denied Redwan's claim that the federal military now controls most of their region. On Thursday, the US State Department's Bureau for African Affairs said that Ethiopians in Tigray and the nearby Amhara and Afar regions need aid now. Quote, Redwan Hussein said in Nairobi that by week's end, humanitarian aid would flow unhindered as agreed in Pretoria, end quote, the Bureau said on Twitter, adding that it was waiting urgently for actions to respect and implement the agreement. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, liberal rights advocate Natasha Pirc-Mercer has won a runoff vote to become Slovenia's next president and the small European Union's country's first female head of state. With nearly all of the votes counted, Pirc-Mercer was leading former Conservative Prime Minister Anze Logar by 54% to 46%. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, announced it has launched a global funding campaign to help people forcibly displaced by war and persecution survive the bitterly cold winter ahead. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The campaign aims to raise $700 million this year to help families who are living under perilous conditions in Ukraine, Afghanistan, and across the Middle East so they can cope with freezing temperatures. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Serrado says the many people who have been forced to flee their homes will be facing an extremely harsh winter. She says it will be difficult for them to provide for their daily needs, given the steep rise in the cost of food, fuel, and other basic commodities. She adds they also will struggle with the lingering impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and threats posed by the climate crisis.
For many of the world's forcibly displaced, this coming winter will be far more challenging than in recent years. Many displaced families will have no option but to choose between food and warmth as they struggle to heat their shelters, source warm clothing, and cook hot meals.
The UNHCR is suffering from a serious funding shortfall, which has forced it to scale back some life-saving programs around the world. The agency cannot count on the usual international donors to provide for its needs. Therefore, the Global Winter Funding Campaign is reaching out to everyone for support. Serrato notes the campaign is appealing to governments, public and private corporations, and individuals to help keep refugees safe and warm this winter.
We see already night temperatures dropping to 2 to 4 degrees in all these regions, but this is just the beginning. So urgent support is needed to be able to start delivering cash assistance, thermal blankets, work clothing, repairing the houses as soon as possible before the winter becomes even harsher.
The UNHCR reports some 7 million Ukrainians are displaced inside the country and 7.6 million have fled as refugees across Europe. Serrato says UNHCR teams are providing supplies to the displaced Ukrainians and helping to reinforce homes and shelters to keep out the cold. In Afghanistan, she says the UNHCR plans to support 50,500 families or about 400,000 people with cash assistance. She says aid workers now are delivering essential items like blankets, solar panels, and winter insulation for tents to help displaced families survive the harsh winter months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australian researchers have identified 1,500 additional locations across the country that could be used as pumped storage hydropower facilities. They said it should reduce Australia's reliance on fossil fuels. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Academics at the Australian National University have said pumped storage hydropower is a low-cost mass storage option that could help Australia reach its emissions reduction targets. Emeritus Professor Andrew Blakers at the University's College of Engineering, Computing and Cybernetics told VOA the process involves transferring water between two reservoirs or lakes at different elevations. He said water is pumped to the higher reservoir when there are plentiful supplies of wind and solar energy. The water is then released at night or at other times when it's not windy or sunny, maximising the use of the stored energy in the reservoirs.
We have two reservoirs, one at the top of a hill and the other down in a valley, connected with a pipe or tunnel. On sunny and windy days, the pump turbine pumps water uphill to the upper reservoir. And then in the middle of the night, the water is allowed to come back down through the turbine to recover the energy that was stored. So the same water goes up and down between the two reservoirs for 100 years. So if you want large-scale storage, you go to pumped hydro.
Researchers studied the area near every reservoir in Australia, looking for a potential site for another reservoir that could be used as pumped storage hydropower. They identified 1,500 locations that could help Australia store the energy it generates from wind and solar projects. Blakers says Australia is becoming a world leader in the field.
All Australian governments and companies are focused on very rapid construction of solar and wind and equally rapid construction of new transmission to bring the new power to the cities and pumped hydro and battery storage to balance the variable solar and wind. Australia is the global pathfinder. We are leading in every department.
Australia has a target of producing 82% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2030. Because of the country's heavy reliance on coal and natural gas, it has been one of the world's worst emitters of greenhouse gases per capita. Those fossil fuels continue to generate much of Australia's electricity. But researchers believe that the country's path toward a cleaner energy future is well underway. The Australian National University study released Friday follows the team's identification of 530,000 potential pumped storage hydro sites across the world. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
On November 10th, NASA launched a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket from the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. The rocket carried the new Joint Polar Satellite System, or JPSS-2, for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA's Low Earth Orbit flight test of an inflatable decelerator, or LOFTID. The NOAA JPSS-2 and two other satellites already in polar orbit will form a fleet that will help with weather forecasting, foresee extreme weather, and keep an eye on climate change. Once the JPSS-2 reaches its final orbit in about a week after launch, NASA says the spacecraft will be renamed NOAA 21. NASA's LOFTID is a test of a new inflatable heat shield or aeroshell technology that could in the future help safely land astronauts on Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs program Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Gina Rolfo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the resumption of fighting by the March 23rd Movement Armed Group, or M23, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a written statement, "The resumption of hostilities since October 20th has caused significant human suffering, including deaths and injuries among civilians, and significant numbers of newly displaced persons. The United States calls for an immediate cessation of hostilities and respect for human rights and international humanitarian law." M23 is a militant group operating in eastern DRC, made up of rebels who defected from the DRC's armed forces. There are credible reports it is supported by the government of Rwanda. The M23 and some of its leaders, including Sultani Makenga, have been sanctioned by the United States and the United Nations for horrific attacks on civilians. M23 fighters recently seized multiple towns and two major roads in the DRC's North Kivu province. At least 20 civilians were killed, at least 50 were injured, and 6 peacekeepers from the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or MONUSCO, were injured. The offensive has displaced an estimated 475,000 people since October 20th, with another 200,000 unable to leave occupied areas. The United States calls for M23 to withdraw from its positions, disarm, and rejoin the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, Nairobi process, in preparation for disarmament, demobilization, and community reintegration offered by the government of the DRC, said State Department spokesperson Price. At a Security Council briefing, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative of Special Affairs, called on Rwanda to cease its support for the M23 and noted that MONUSCO remains critical to bringing peace to eastern DRC and the broader region. It serves an important purpose, protecting civilians, disrupting illicit networks, and helping stabilize governance and security institutions, he said. Ambassador Wood emphasized achieving peace is contingent upon a political process, political will, and political solutions. To that end, he said, the United States announced in September an additional $30 million in funding to support a transparent electoral process in the DRC, strengthening democratic institutions, bringing justice to victims, holding bad actors to account, respecting states' territorial sovereignty and integrity, and prioritizing civilians will help bring peace to the Great Lakes. The people of the region deserve nothing less.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.